At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
So he understood. I mean, it's clear from his letters that he understood. He says so. And he's very loving in what he says to her. He goes to see her father's grave, which is in Vienna, and tells her he's taken some care of that and so on. It's very sad.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app so that you don't miss out on future episodes. Liz Cohn has been researching Alice Glasnerova, who was imprisoned as part of the early Cold War Czechoslovak show trials known as the Slansky Trials. These were amongst the most notorious show trials of the 20th century, with the prosecution and sentencing to death of Rudolf Slansky, General Secretary of the Czechoslovak Communist Party, and 10 other defendants who had been arrested in a brutal purge ordered by Stalin. Alice Glasnerova was Liz's father's first wife, and when Liz started researching Alice's life, she'd never seen a picture of her and had never read a word that she had written. All she knew was that Alice had been married to her father and had been a member of the Communist Party. Liz has pieced together a tragic story of a couple, although deeply in love, separated by the difference in their political views, which ultimately resulted in pain, disillusion, and betrayal. Now, you might think there's a vast army of research assistants, audio engineers, and producers putting together this podcast, but you'd be wrong. The podcast relies on your support to enable me to continue to capture these incredible stories and make them available to everyone for free. If you'd like to help preserve Cold War history and enable me to continue to produce this podcast, you can, via a one-off or monthly donation. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more details. If a financial contribution is not your cup of tea, then you can still help us by leaving written reviews wherever you listen to us, as well as sharing us on social media. It really helps us get new guests on the show. Now, back to today's episode. I'm delighted to welcome Liz Cohn to our Cold War conversation. One theme that I feel that runs through this story is of her independence and her single-mindedness. I'm trying not to generalize this too much, but she seems quite unusual for this period in terms of what she does and how she acts as well.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting because her mother certainly didn't want her to go in the direction that she did. Her mother wanted her to, you know, to make a good marriage and to, you know, to have social advancement, which was obviously something that Alice was not interested in at all. So she was an independent spirit, and Helena, her friend, was as well. So I think the two of them together were quite a bold pair, really.
Yeah, quite a formidable duo from what I can make out. And so how does she meet your father?
I think she met him when she was at university in Prague. He was also at university in Prague. He was a bit older than she was. He was studying medicine. But he came from a little town in Slovakia called Žilina, which is not very far from Ružomberok. And I think the Jewish students, the Slovak students, probably there was a group of them, and through them she got to know him.
And she was the first female lawyer in that town, I think you said.
Yeah, when she graduated, she actually went back first of all to Ružomberok because her father had died, and so she sort of partly went to look after her mother and younger sister. And she was the first female lawyer in Ružomberok. And then when she and my father married in 29, they moved to Žilina, which is where his family came from. And and she was the first female lawyer there as well. So, yeah, she was quite a pioneer.
Indeed, indeed. And as you mentioned, she's developing socialist views and is obviously of a left-wing persuasion. But with your father, what was his politics like?
He was a social democrat. And I think at that time, the differences between him as a social democrat, when they met, him as a social democrat and her as a communist, were not too great. You know, their values were pretty similar, and the communists were relatively recently formed in Czechoslovakia. So I think although Alice was always more involved in communist, in socialist ideals and politics than he was, Their values were not so different. I mean, they were both involved in the Social Democratic Party to begin with in Žilina, but Alice's sympathies were moving towards the communists, and she carried on going to meetings with my father, and reporting back to the communists. They said, "Don't join the Communist Party yet. We'd rather you reported back on what's going on with the Social Democrats." So already there was a little bit of a division there going on. She joined the Friends of the USSR, and she actually went for 6 weeks on a study tour to the Soviet Union. It obviously didn't add any concerns about what was going on. I mean, because there were show trials going on in the Soviet Union in the 30s. So, you know, she didn't seem to be aware of that. And she actually there was a talk in Žilina, which was quite controversial, where somebody was refuting the views of André Gide, who had been also to the Soviet Union and had been quite critical of it, but the attitude in Žilina amongst the communists there was against those views. So, as far as I know, she came back being impressed. I think you also have to remember how sort of old fashioned the world was, and how in Austro-Hungary, and then even the beginnings of Czechoslovakia, that it was a very formal world where people were very respectful. And I think to go to the Soviet Union and see men and women working alongside each other and everybody being called comrade and that sort of equality, I think that must have seemed quite appealing, actually.
Yeah, yeah. And I think people sort of forget that to some degree, that a lot of... a lot of what we experience today in terms of equality was very much groundbreaking in those times in the Soviet Union, and certainly women would have seen it as very invigorating, I would think, to see that equality, or appear to see that equality there, because I mean the equality was only to a certain level, wasn't it?
Yeah, it seemed like that at the time. I think it seemed as though women were going to be treated with greater equality, and that they were going to be expected or allowed, whichever way you look at it, to work alongside men. I mean, of course, what happened later was very different, but at that time, I think it seemed as though that was what communism was offering.
So she doesn't join the party immediately. It's 1936 when she joins the Communist Party, and that is a very important year for both the Communist Party and, I guess, for European history, because it's the start of the Spanish Civil War, which is an iconic event for the left wing, certainly during the 1930s.
Yes, and also you have to remember that Czechoslovakia was a neighbour of Germany, and by that time Hitler was enacting laws as well, and I think that it was possible to see, and they, you know, they were very well educated. They spoke German, they spoke English, they spoke French. They could read newspapers and books and articles from all over Europe, and they knew what was going on. And it was very, if you were Jewish particularly, it was very, very worrying. And then obviously what was going on in Spain as well. And it seemed as though Spain was the only place that anybody was challenging that fascist ideology.
Alice actually goes to Spain and leaves Erwin behind.
Yes. Her friend Helena goes slightly before she does. She went in sort of May 37, by which time, you know, the civil war was well underway, and Mussolini and Hitler were on the side of Franco, very obviously, and then Hitler would use the Luftwaffe to bomb, you know, the Basque town of Guernica. So, and the Soviet Union was very clearly, you know, on the side of the Republicans and was intervening in that way as well. So she was going into a, you know, sides that were very clearly defined by the time she got there. I mean, Helena was a pharmacist, and so it was obvious what she was going to do. She went to work with the International Brigade Hospitals. The Czechs sent money to set up a Czech hospital for the International Brigade fighters, and Helena volunteered to work there as a pharmacist. Alice, as a lawyer, it wasn't quite so obvious what she would do, really. But when she got there, she ended up working as administrator in the various hospitals. But in the summer of 37, she was getting letters from Helena about what it was like. And I think she couldn't bear to stay away any longer. And she knew my father wouldn't approve. And so she said she was going on holiday to Belgium to visit her mother and sister who were holidaying there. And from she went to Paris and asked the communists to help her get to Spain, which they did. I mean, she did go and visit her mother, and I'm sure they were absolutely horrified. Her mother was horrified to hear what she was going to do. And she took the train with some other comrades down to Perpignan, and then they were taken by boat from Cerbère, which is a little village just on the border, across the border into Spain to Port Bou, which is the little village on the Spanish side. And from there, she went to Figueres, where there's a fort and where a lot of the international brigades sort of gathered, and sent a telegram to my father explaining where she was and saying that they belonged to two different worlds. So I think, you know, that was quite a defining moment, really.
We've mentioned the international brigades. It's worth describing who they are. And the international brigades were international volunteers from various countries, including Britain, the US, Czechoslovakia, even German volunteers as well, who wanted to fight on the side of the Republic.
Even
who
Italians.
Were fighting against Franco. Yeah, even Italian
on
as
both
well.
Sides, yeah.
Yeah. And this was a sort of very powerful moment for the left wing in Europe, because it was, you know, a chance to try and turn this tide of fascism that was appearing to be in a quite an unstoppable wave across Europe, what with the rise of Hitler and also Mussolini in Italy, who'd been in power for significantly longer than Hitler had, and you know, to stop it happening in Spain as well.
Yeah, I mean, towards the end, they were in Benicassim for several months, but then as the nationalists advanced, they had to move north to make sure that they weren't cut off by the nationalist advance. And so they went to Barcelona, and then the next place that the hospital was in Mataró. But what I think is quite important to say is that as the Republicans were clearly losing the fight, the Soviets started to look for scapegoats. As to why. And Alice and her friends, both Helena and a doctor called Dora, whom she became friends with while she was out in Spain, were all accused of demoralising the troops and of having stolen preserves from the hospital. And they had to appear in front of a communist tribunal in Barcelona. Nothing was proved against them. But as a result of that, their communications were intercepted and censored and read. And in fact, I have some of the letters that were intercepted by the communist authorities in Spain afterwards. But that particular incident becomes quite important later.
Indeed, it does. I mean, you mentioned the telegram that she sent to your father. Have you any indication of what the reaction was from Irwin?
He did carry on communicating with her while she was there, and he did send things out to her while she was there, including medicines for the hospital. But I think he was very dismayed that's what she had done. The only comment I have about his feelings about that was in something he wrote for the interrogatory, which was for a particular audience. I haven't mentioned the interrogatory, but actually it's quite important because that was my starting point in researching Alice. My father in 1954 was working for the World Health Organization. He was an American civil servant, and he had to fill in a form that all international civil servants had to complete, saying that he wasn't a communist, basically. And in responding to that, he said his first wife had been a communist. And because of that, they then sent him an additional questionnaire in which he had to write in much more detail about his marriage and the reasons for the divorce and so on. And that was my starting point in the research. That was the first sort of detail that I got, that I knew really about what had happened in their marriage. But it is obviously for a very specific audience. It's for the American government, proving that he's not a communist. So you have to read it in that light.
What happens to her after the Spanish Civil War?
She left Spain in August of 1938 and actually was arrested as soon as she got into France. They walked over the border, over the mountains to France, and were arrested. She and four other comrades arrested straight away and imprisoned for a month because they were without a visa. But after that, when she was released, she returned to Czechoslovakia and got back to Žilina end of August 1938. And obviously that was just before the Munich Agreement. So she returned, and as a result of the Munich Agreement, Slovakia became an autonomous state under the rule of the Slovak nationalists. And the leader of the Slovak nationalists was a priest called Joseph Tiso, who was very much a fascist and was indicted for war crimes after the war, and was amongst, you know, one of the first rulers to ship a lot of Jews to Auschwitz. So in 1938, when they knew what was happening, they wanted to leave Czechoslovakia. And luckily, my father had an American passport. Although he had been brought up for most of his life in Czechoslovakia and in Žilina, he actually was born in New York because his parents had emigrated in the 19th century, had met there, married. He was born there, and then in 1910 they'd returned home. So he still had an American passport, which made it much easier for them to leave. And so in December 1938, he went to America, and Alice followed a year later.
So quite a close escape then for the pair of them.
Yes, I think Slovakia had become quite anti-Semitic. I mean, by the time Alice returned, I think my father could have told her about many incidents of anti-Semitism, and they only grew. And very, very sadly, my father's parents, my grandparents, could have gone to America with them, but chose not to. They wanted to stay in what they saw as their home, and they felt they were old and nobody would bother with them, and that, you know, there'd been anti-Semitic waves, persecutions before, and they could last it out, and of course they couldn't. So
tragic story. So many families in Eastern Europe. What do Irwin and Alice do in the US? Are they sort of reconciled at that point, or?
I guess so. I mean, they were apart for a whole year while she was in Spain, and then they were together for 3 months, and he went to America, and then they were apart for another year because he was in America. He had to do the American exam so that he could practice as a doctor in the States because they didn't recognize his European qualifications. And so he went a year early, and she wanted to make sure that her mother and her sister were safe, which they were. And so she joined him then in 1938. So I guess, yes, they did come together. It was a slightly tricky time for communists because the Soviet Union had made a pact with Hitler, hadn't they? Their non-aggression pact. And people like Alice had seen firsthand the danger of Hitler in Spain and in Czechoslovakia. And so I think it was quite difficult to reconcile the Communist Party policy of not getting involved in the war when she felt, you know, that in a way they needed to. But when they went into the war, then they were all on the same side. Alice worked for something called the International Workers' Order when she was in America, which was a communist organization, and she worked in the Slovak section. And she also was a volunteer in various refugee organizations, helping people escape from Europe into America, often via Mexico. And my father joined the army in 1942 when America joined the war. He joined the army and was with the Second Evacuation Hospital and was sent to Europe and went over on the D-Day landings and followed the American army through into France and Belgium and then ultimately into Germany.
Did he talk to you about that at all, or did
he never spoke about it? But I have letters now as a result of the thoroughness of the Communist Party confiscating things, particularly a letter in which he describes he was at the liberation of Buchenwald and had to set up a hospital, a TB hospital for the survivors. He found his uncle there and some schoolmates there.
Oh, my goodness.
He was also sent to denazify certain hospitals and to arrest the Nazis that were there. And he got some medals from it. He was ideal because he spoke German, and yet obviously he was American. And he said he got the reputation of the guy who can be tough on the Nazis. So I think he really enjoyed seeing his Jewish name being put up above the hospitals that he was taking over. Yeah.
God, that must have been incredible to find relatives still alive in that camp. Can't imagine what that moment would have been like, to be honest. But thanks for sharing that.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
So with the end of the war, what does Alice do next?
Well, obviously, Alice was desperate to return to Czechoslovakia as soon as she could. My father didn't go back to America until December 45. And it was at that time, between the end of the war and my father's return, that she met Noel Field. And that proved to be a hugely significant event in both their lives. Shall I just say a little bit about Noel Field?
Yeah. Who is Noel Field?
Okay, Noel Field was an American. He was brought up in Switzerland, spoke German, went to school in Switzerland. His parents were both American. Then he went to Harvard. Then he joined the State Department and the League of Nations. He was very idealistic, a bit naive, really, a bit so socially sort of awkward, really. And he became very interested in communism. He read a lot about it. And while he was working at the State Department, he was recruited by the Russians. He was very sympathetic to that. And one of his best friends then, Lawrence Duggan, also volunteered to work for the Soviets. He knew Alger Hiss. He was friendly with Alger Hiss. Who was working for the GRU, which is the military intelligence branch of the Soviet Union. And people did begin to suspect, he wasn't particularly subtle about it, people did begin to suspect his communism, and actually that was one of the reasons that he left the State Department and also the League of Nations. And by the time he met Alice, he was working for the Unitarian Service Committee, and he'd been working throughout the war in Geneva, helping refugees from occupied Europe and particularly helping the communists, because that was where his sympathies lay. And so, and he'd met a couple called the Pavliks, who were Czech, who knew Alice well. In fact, Alice had worked in Geza Pavlik's law firm when she first graduated in Ružomberok. They were vaguely related. And the Pavliks suggested that when he went back to America, he look up Alice which he did. And they got on quite well because they were, you know, their sympathies were very similar. And of course, Alice was desperate to have any news from anybody she knew in Czechoslovakia. And my father hadn't yet returned. So that was how they got to know each other. Alice had no idea that he was actually working. She knew he had communist sympathies. She had no idea he was working for the Soviet Union. And Field wanted to set up a medical teaching, well, the Unitarian Service Committee wanted to set up a medical teaching mission to various European countries, to Czechoslovakia and then Austria, Poland, Finland, because the doctors in those countries had missed out on a lot of the developments that had happened during the war, because obviously, you know, under Nazism, they weren't allowed to know about any of them. And actually, Czechoslovakia had lost a huge percentage of its doctors because they were Jewish, and they'd either been killed or they'd left the country. So Alice suggested my father, and because he was ideal, you know, he was a doctor, he trained in Vienna and in Prague, and yet he was an American, and that was what happened. So in spring 1946, they returned to Czechoslovakia, my father to organise the medical teaching mission, and Alice to go back and see her family and her friends and so on. And she stayed. At the end of that year, he went back to America to organise the next year's missions. But Alice stayed in Prague because you know, she'd been away for so long.
Yeah, yeah. And can you explain what the political situation was like in Czechoslovakia during that period?
Yeah, I mean, from 1946, there was a coalition government, and the communists were a part of that government, with Beneš, who was not a communist. And he tried, Beneš, to sort of balance the West and the East. He felt that the Czechoslovakia, I mean, he'd been in England during the war, and yet he'd had help from the Soviets and had actually returned to Czechoslovakia under the auspices of the Soviet Union via the Soviet Union. But he sort of hoped that he could balance, be at the centre of Europe, and balance the two sides that were emerging in the post-war world. Yeah, unfortunately, as time showed, he wasn't able to do that. But at that time, and the communists who were in government were very clever, really. They started working with the grassroots. They started working on the ground with farmers and with in the different regions in Czechoslovakia. And so that people got to know them. And the communists had two advantages. One was that the Americans had agreed to let the Soviets liberate Prague. So General Patton's army had stayed in Pilsen and had not liberated Prague, while Prague was, you know, uprising against the Nazis. They waited for the Soviets to come in, so they got the kudos for that. And, of course, the Munich Agreement. There was still a lot of resentment in Czechoslovakia about the fact that the West had abandoned them at the beginning of the war. They had hoped that France and Britain would help them fight the Nazis. They were ready to fight. There's a letter from my father that he wrote in 1938 saying that they were all ready to fight. And then, of course, the Munich Agreement gave away the Sudetenland, which is where all their defences were and armaments were situated. And so they had no chance.
But in 1948, the communists seized power properly.
In 1948, all of the non-communist members of the government resigned in protest at something the communists had done, and thinking that would bring down the government. But what it did was hand power to the communists. The communists then just filled their empty posts with communists. And so effectively, you know, there was a bloodless putsch or coup. And the communists from February 1948, the communists were then in full control of Czechoslovakia. Yeah.
And what's happening between Alice and Erwin at this time?
For those 2 years, 1946 to 1948, Erwin was working for the USC, and Alice was in Czechoslovakia for a while. She did go back with Erwin to America at the end of 1947, and they had a very sad and unhappy Christmas that year. And she was ill and very, very unhappy at being there. And then after the communist takeover, she wanted to be back in Czechoslovakia and helping to build a new communist world, as she saw it. She saw it as that opportunity. And so in March 1948, she came back and she got a job in the office of the Deputy Prime Minister, Willem Scharocki, and she worked there. And my father had resigned from the USC then, and he was he got a job with the World Health Organization in Geneva because he didn't want to live under a communist regime. So effectively, you know, things were separating between them. But my father's belongings were still in the flat. He was still going backwards and forwards. So that was sort of where they were in 48.
And I think that's a, you know, it's another era of the story here is, despite the fact that they appear to be separated, Alice is still looking after his belongings. And, you know, as we move further into this story, there's a story about what happens to those belongings as well. But it's as though there's still a connection there. It's not as though they're, you know, these irreconcilable differences.
I think the reality is that they did love each other. They did. And I think she, from what she kept about him and from what she'd obviously said to other people, she loved him. But she also loved Czechoslovakia. And there was her belief in communism, but I think also her home. Because I think for Erwin, Czechoslovakia was his home, but never quite in the same way as it was for Alice. You know, he wasn't born there. He was brought up until he was nine in New York. And he was with the US Army for several years. And what he saw of the Soviets during his time in the army in Europe hardened him completely against the communists. He was never going to live under their regime. So it was difficult. It was difficult, clearly, for them. I think they had a lot of great heartache, the two of them.
Yeah.
And you can see that in some later letters, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, in terms of the correspondence between them, did they talk much about politics or try and avoid that because they knew that, you know, they were on not completely opposite sides, but, you know, there was a...
I don't have many of their letters. I mean, of the letters I do have, are information about the war, and then the letters surrounding their divorce, which comes a little bit later.
In 49, Erwin gets a job at the World Health Organization in Geneva. Alice is staying in Prague, but in that year, she's arrested.
Yes, and this is where Noel Field comes back into it, because Noel Field and Erwin and Alice had been in contact during the USC missions, but Noel Field was dismissed from the USC in 47, again, because of his communist sympathies. And in 48, he was quite worried that his American passport was running out, and he was worried that it was not going to be renewed, because there were the House Committee for Un-American Activities, the HUAC hearings, in America, and he ended up being named by Whittaker Chambers as a communist during those hearings. And so he asked Alice and various other people, other Czech communists, if they would help him get a residency visa for Czechoslovakia, because he felt he would be safe there. And she did help him with that. But then his passport was renewed. And she was slightly suspicious of that. She wondered why it was that had happened. And she spoke to the communist authorities about it. And she said, you know, I just wonder. And so they said, well, can you keep an eye on him and report back where he is and what he's doing? And she said she would, which she did. And in October 48, the New York Herald Tribune printed the information that he had been named as a communist by Whittaker Chambers, and he became very worried. And then in December 48, his friend from the State Department, who was also working for the Soviet Union, Lawrence Duggan, committed suicide. And so Noel Field was very, very jittery, and he was in Prague and he wanted to see Alice, and she had to go away. She had to go away for a work trip. She'd actually been demoted from her job as in the Deputy Prime Minister's office and was working for Czech hotels. It just so happened my father was in Prague at the time. Noel Field went and spoke to him and said how worried he was. And so when Alice returned from her trip, my father went back to Geneva. Alice returned from her trip. She contacted Noel Field at his hotel. And he wasn't there. His luggage was still there, but he disappeared. And she didn't know what had happened. And Herta was very worried about him and assumed that he'd been taken by the Americans. And both Noel Field's wife and Noel Field's brother went looking for him. They came to Czechoslovakia. And Herman went to Poland because he had contacts there to try and find out what had happened to Noel Field. And both Herman Field, Noel's brother, and Noel's wife, Herta, also disappeared. Nobody knew where any of them had gone. In fact, both Noel Field and Herta had been arrested and taken to Hungary, and Herman Field was detained in Poland. And then the Pavliks disappeared. They were the couple whom Alice had known and who recommended Noel Field contact her. And then a friend of hers who'd been in Spain, one of the doctors in Spain, Vlasta, also disappeared. So people were being arrested all around her there in 49.
Was this being orchestrated by the Soviet Union, these waves of arrests?
Yes, it was since Tito had left the Comintern and had separated Yugoslavia from the Soviet Union, Stalin wanted to increase his hold on the other countries that he saw as being in his sphere of influence. And he started, and the way he wanted to do that was by doing what he'd done in the Soviet Union in the 30s, which was, you know, a reign of terror, show trials, proving that there were fifth columnists and, you know, Western spies in the higher echelons of the Communist Party and government in Hungary and then in Czechoslovakia. And Noel Field was taken to Hungary, tortured there, as were the Pavliks, in order to get evidence for a trial of somebody called Laszlo Rajk, R-A-J-K, in Hungary. And what Stalin did very cleverly with Noel Field was he accused Noel Field, he got people to accuse Noel Field of being an American spy. He was an American, and of course he had lots of contacts with communists, but he wasn't an American spy, he was a communist spy. But he was accused of being an American spy, and anybody who had had contact with him was in danger and was implicated. And that was when people found out where Noel Field was, because in the Rajk trial he was named as having been an American spy. And then the pressure moved on into Czechoslovakia and to say to try and find something similar in Czechoslovakia. And in July of 49, Alice also was arrested.
And she's held in some quite tough prisons as well.
The first prison she was taken to was Mlada Boleslav, which was a prison for regular criminals, but there the secret services commandeered one floor of it for political prisoners, because actually she was amongst the very first ones to be arrested, and they didn't have a whole prison designated for political prisoners as they did later. And she was kept there. And I've been to Mlada Boleslav. I've seen it. It hasn't been in use as a prison since the 50s. So it's actually very much as it was at that time. It's used as a film set now.
Right.
And in fact, I've seen films when I've suddenly gone, oh my God, I know what that is. That's Mlada Boleslav. The film The Courier with Benedict Cumberbatch quite recently used.
All right. Yeah.
Anyway. And the Soviets were there, if you like, instructing the Czechs about how to interrogate. You know, they vied with each other for doing the longest interrogations, and they made people go through their whole life stories and write it all down and then go over it all over again and look at any discrepancy and name everybody they'd met. And, of course, Alice and other communists just thought it was a mistake. And that as soon as they explained what had really happened, that they would be released and it would be understood. It took them a while to understand that nobody was interested in the truth. That wasn't on the cards at all.
Was there an anti-Semitic theme to these trials or these arrests, or was that some of the later trials that
That comes a little bit later, but yes, I mean, she was actually released after this first arrest. She was released after about 10 months on certain conditions. One was that she give up her membership of the Communist Party. Another was that she examine her values very carefully. Another was that she divorced my father. And finally, that she didn't tell people that she'd been in prison. She was actually sent to a resort in northern Czechoslovakia for 2 weeks and then allowed to return home. And that was when she wrote to my father and said that they needed to divorce. And I have those letters. I have the letters that she wrote and his reply.
What were his replies to that? Did he want the divorce as well? Or
The two letters were the only two letters I had of hers, then my father had obviously kept them, and they were written in Slovak. And at the time I first had them, I couldn't understand Slovak, and Google Translate didn't exist. And my husband went to Czech Republic, and I asked him to take the letters with him and get them translated. And they came back and they said, oh, they're not very interesting. They're just very practical things saying about the practicalities of the divorce. And actually the letter begins something like this: I've come back from a long trip. And it's clear from my father's reply that he knows exactly where she's been, that he understands exactly that she's been in prison. And in fact, I found that there's another letter that he wrote just after she was arrested the first time. He wrote because he'd been planning to return to Czechoslovakia, to Prague. And he wrote to Eva in the end because he said, I've been writing to Alice and she's not replying and I don't know what's happening.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
And I don't know whatever replied. But obviously he realised that she disappeared or that she'd been arrested. And of course, he could never go back again. So he understood. I mean, it's clear from his letters that he understood, he says so. And he's very loving in what he says to her. He goes to see her father's grave, which is in Vienna, and tells her he's taken some care of that and so on. It's very sad.
It is. This is so, I mean, this is one of the things that drew me to this story, because it is a tragic love story. and how, you know, those letters, that exchange between your father and Alice there, they're having to use this coded language. It sounds like he obviously understands that she has to do this in order to gain her freedom.
Yeah.
But neither of them really have an appetite to be divorced. Incredibly sad. And sadly for Alice, things get worse in 1951.
The group that were arrested with Alice, Gottwald and the Czech authorities, were investigating at the instigation of the Soviets to try and find this conspiracy. And their view was that there really wasn't a conspiracy. And Stalin said, well, look harder, because I think you'll find there is one. And so everything ramped up then. And she was released in March 1950. And she'd served the last part of her imprisonment was in Ruzin, which is a big prison in Prague. And that had been completely converted into a prison for political prisoners. It was entirely for political prisoners. So you can imagine, it's a huge prison. Like, I've been there as well. They knew how many they were going to be arresting. I mean, they were arresting hundreds and hundreds of people, not just communists, obviously. They were Catholics and priests and dissidents and so on, but also a lot of communists. And they were ramping up to try and find people who were high enough up in the communist hierarchy that would satisfy Stalin's view. And in the end, of course, they went as high as Rudolf Slansky, who was second only to Gottwald, had spent, you know, the war in the Soviet Union with Gottwald and was as close as he could be to him. And in February, so Alice was released in March 1950. In February, both her best friends, Helena and Dora, were arrested. And all around, people were disappearing from the streets, were being arrested. And it was only a matter of time, really, before she was arrested again, which she was. And throughout that time, I think they used Dora and Alice and others to gain as much information as they could about the people they wanted to put on trial with Slansky, because they weren't so interested, I think, in Alice and Dora, but just they had the contacts and they could get information from them. And the Slansky trial was in November 1952. There were 14 defendants, and 11 of them were executed. And it was a huge trial. It was broadcast across the country. And even the wives of some of the defendants were believed that their husbands must have done what they said they'd done, because there were two impossible things to believe. You know, either these people who had been loyal all their lives to the communists, who had fought in Spain, who a lot of them were Jewish and had been in the resistance and had been in concentration camps, that these people had suddenly been undermining the communists all the way along. That was one impossible thing to believe. But the other impossible thing to believe was that they hadn't done it, and all these intelligent people had been forced to confess to something that they hadn't done. I mean, obviously the second was the truth, but it was a hard thing for anybody to believe.
And these Slansky trials are quite, I was going to say famous, but they're notorious, and are quite certainly a very notable period in Czechoslovak history, and a notable period during the Cold War, again, because of this Soviet manipulation of Stalin trying to assert his grip on the countries of Eastern Europe. But there's also of these defendants, the vast majority of them are Jewish in the Slansky trial.
They are, 11. And you spoke about the anti-Semitic element, and it was definitely there, because as well as being accused of being Titoist and Trotskyist, they were accused of being Zionist. And the attitude to the Jews Jews had been encouraged to join the Communist Party back in the Spanish Civil War, or fight against fascism. But Stalin and the Soviet Union had thought that Israel would be an ally. And in fact, the Czech communists had sent a lot of arms to Israel at the beginning of just after the war. But Israel threw its lot in with America, went on the American side in the Korean War. And Stalin had to court somebody else in the Middle East, had to start courting the Arabs. And it was easier, so much easier, to blame Jews within the Communist Party for the previous support for Israel. He could distance it from himself and blame it on these Zionist sympathizers, Zionist Trotskyist sympathizers. And so there came to be a huge anti-Semitic element in all of that. And obviously Alice and Dora and Helena were all Jewish as well. And they were it was routine insults, as well as obviously the terrible conditions on which they were kept and interrogated and subjected to. But in addition, you know, this sort of, and I think so hard for them when they had survived the war, that they'd survived Hitler's anti-Semitism, to then find the communists using exactly the same insults.
This is a sad story in many ways, but that whole of those people who had dedicated their lives to the fight against fascism and other areas, to then find that the system that they believed in was basically going to eat them. You know, it was going to destroy them.
Yes, I mean, Helena, who was Alice's school friend, when she was arrested, she was incredibly loyal. She worked for the Czech army throughout the war and after the war, And she thought that when she was arrested, that there had been a coup. It never occurred to her that her own party would have done that to her. And it was only when she was taken in for interrogation and she saw the picture of Gottwald behind her interrogator on the wall that she realised there hadn't been a coup. And she then had that she her assumption then was that there'd been a terrible mistake and that they were that they were mistaken and as soon as they found out they would change their minds.
Yeah. So she's held in prison. Could Irwin still write to her or communicate with her while she was in prison or not?
No one could communicate with her. Her mother kept writing to the president and so asking what had happened to her, where she was, could they hear from her? And she had no communication with anybody. I mean, I'm sure Irwin didn't try to write after their divorce, but her family tried and got absolutely nowhere. Yeah.
Right. And so did they know that she was in prison and alive, or they didn't really know where she was and what her circumstances were?
I think they would have known had she died. I mean, the only one woman was ever executed, Milada Horakova. So I think they would have known if she'd been executed. So they just knew that she was in prison. And they may not have known which prison. They would have assumed it was Ruzin, I think, because most political prisoners were in Ruzin. In 1953, Stalin died and so did Gottwald. And actually after that, although the trials went ahead, they did get a response to say that she would be, that her trial would be coming up in spring of 1954. So she'd been in prison for 3 years before she was tried. Wow. She was charged with espionage, contact with other enemies of democracy, and demoralizing behavior in Spain. The return of the stolen
came back to haunt her.
Yeah. And in fact, by which time Gottwald had died, the regime had begun to change in the Soviet Union. And she was very, very ill. I mean, the prison doctor described her as having had anemia, an arterial defect, spinal tuberculosis, intervertebral disc herniation, jaundice, bilateral sciatic nerve neuralgia, and chronic gastric catarrh. And he recommended that if she wasn't released, that she might not survive because the conditions were just unbearable in the prison.
Yeah.
And so she was released in 1955. And when they finally reviewed her case later, the prosecutor had asked for the charges to be dropped before it had come to trial because they didn't feel anything had been, that there was enough evidence. But the Secret Service put pressure on and insisted that she was tried. She was sentenced to 8 years. And Dora was sentenced to 6 because she didn't come from such a bourgeois background. She got 2 extra years for being bourgeois.
Incredible.
But, yes, she was released in 1955.
In the meantime, your father has married your mother.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the very, very, again, one of the very sad things. I mean, I'm not sure exactly when she found out, but she must have found out fairly soon because they had people they were in contact with in common. That he'd married my mother in 1953 and I was born a month before her trial. And they had wanted children. She and my father had definitely wanted children. And my father had thought that she wouldn't have thrown herself so wholeheartedly into the communist cause had she had children. Maybe she would have been more careful about risking herself if she had had children, but I'm sure she would have still been a communist. And so it just seems very sad that added to everything else, you know, she had to sort of take that information on board.
And what happens to her after her release? Is she still a believer?
I think she certainly still believes in the ideals that she believed in when she was young. She still ideologically believes in democracy, in internationalism, in freedom, in equality. She still has those beliefs, and she believes that that's what true communism is. However, the Communist Party has moved very, very far from that. You know, it's shut down international cooperation. It's become misogynistic. I mean, there isn't a woman to be seen in the communist government in Czechoslovakia or sort of the Soviet Union or whatever. And there's certainly no freedom. So it's the party that has changed, that has traduced those ideals. But she wanted to remain, or to have returned to her Communist Party membership, because it was, she was stripped of it, and it took her 7 years. She didn't get it back until 1962, even though she was cleared of her of all charges. She didn't get her Communist Party membership back till 62, and then of course in 68 the Warsaw Pact troops invade, and that is when she gives up being a communist. That's when she gives up her communist membership. But speaking to the sons and daughters of her friends, that generation continued to believe in those ideals, even though, you know, they had all, either they themselves, well, often they themselves, but often, you know, their husbands had been, you know, imprisoned and in some cases executed.
I guess it's been such a big part of your life for so long, it's that the ideals themselves are sound, but it's the people who are implementing it that have got it wrong.
Yeah.
Because I remember reading somewhere about, you know, when people were arrested during Stalin's purges, that, you know, that people were writing to Stalin because they thought he must not know about this. You know, he must not know. It's these people further down that are doing these arrests, and, you know, Uncle Joe would never allow this sort of stuff.
Mm. And I mean, to be fair, until 68, I don't think there was a very strong feeling. There was a belief in the lead up to 68 that it might be possible to have communism with a human face. That was sort of Dubček thing, wasn't it? That it would be possible to have freedom and, you know, fairness and equality. It's only really after 68 that and what was called normalization in Czechoslovakia that you get such an overwhelmingly negative response to communism, and it persists to this day. I mean, understandably so. But what has happened is that all communists have been tarred with the same brush, and that people like Alice and, you know, some of the ideological communists of the 20s and 30s, and who became victims of the regime, are not seen as victims. Their deaths and their imprisonments are not counted in the figures. Their names are not put on the memorials. And it feels, you know, they were the ones who were, they were betrayed.
In others' eyes, I guess they're seen as complicit because they did support the regime initially.
Yeah.
I know it came back to bite them, but, mm-hmm. you know, they were naive, I guess, is how somebody would counter that.
But they couldn't know, could they? When they were young, they couldn't know that was how it would turn out.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things I find fascinating about the ideology of the Cold War, because certainly this sort of forms way before the Cold War, because if you look at groups like the Cambridge Five, mm-hmm. they were very much ideological spies. Mm-hmm. They thought that they were spying for a greater good rather than a national viewpoint. And whichever way you look at them, that was their belief. Maybe in later times, certainly when they ended up in the Soviet Union, they realized that perhaps it wasn't all as you know, good as they thought it was going to be.
I mean, there is a lot of, I mean, there have been quite a few books, haven't there, and sort of arguments that the sharing of information with the Soviet Union through various spy networks actually kept the peace during the Cold War, because the two sides came to understand through back channels that neither side wanted a hot war.
Yeah. So what happens to Irwin's stuff? that Alice has been hanging on to?
Well, everything was confiscated when she was arrested. When she was arrested the second time, the STB, who are the secret police, went through the flat and confiscated. They were there for 24 hours, going through and confiscating belongings and paperwork. And I mean, that's one of the reasons I've actually got letters and documents from my father, because they were confiscated by the STB when Alice was arrested. So there's the letter describing what he did at the end of the war. I would never have had it not been
in the files.
Yeah, in the files. And there are things like there are inventories of all their possessions, all their Rosenthal crockery and all their crystal and so on. And it gives a very vivid picture to have a list of all that their possessions that I would just never have had this not happened. I mean, I don't wish this to have happened to them, but there is a sort of irony in how much I've been able to find out because of the thoroughness of the Communist Party and all that it kept. So I mean, his possessions were never returned to him. And,
yeah.
And Alice only got back a certain amount of what was confiscated from her. She actually had to buy back her own crockery. There were government shops that sold off the property of the people who were arrested and all the property that was confiscated. She had to buy back some of her own china.
Unbelievable. Mm. Unbelievable. Did she live to see the Velvet Revolution?
Oh, sadly not. She died 2 years, 2 years before. She died in 86, so she didn't. But she remained friends. I mean, the Alice and Dora and Helena, the two who had been in Spain with her, remained friends to the end of their lives. They both died before she did. And she was very close to them and their children. And when she retired, she worked when she was released for a book. Publishers. She worked in their legal department, and when she retired, she taught English to often the sons and daughters of her friends. And thank goodness she did, because that's how I've been able to communicate with them. I mean, my Czech is improving now. I actually probably could do it in Czech, but to begin with, I really couldn't. And when I was in Prague in the summer of 2019, I went to the flat that she lived in at the end of her life. Which is now lived in by the daughter of the woman who wrote the memoir about her. She took it over when Alice died, and so some of her furniture was still there. And so we sat at the table where Alice used to teach them English in the flat where
Wow.
she lived, talking to two of the people whom she taught. It was lovely to be able to do that.
Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible. What's next for this story? What are you intending to do next?
I have written it up as a book, and what I'm going to try and do is get it published. I've also setting up a website to try and put on it a lot of the information I have, so that, you know, other people who are researching, you know, related stories have access to it. It doesn't just disappear after I've gone. And I'm thinking I might do an MPhil as well, so to look at slightly more academic, more official way.
There's further information such as photos and videos in our episode notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Now, this show wouldn't exist without our generous Patreons, so I want to thank one and all of them for their support. You can very easily become a Patreon by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. And you can also join our Facebook group, where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Thanks very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.